Hello, this is Alton Banks from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I will be reading from the Triangle Business Journal, the last Triangle Business Journal of 2018. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. So welcome to the Triangle Business Journal. This last issue of the journal for 2018 actually is going to be a little less organized, perhaps, than previous journals, because there's not a print copy of the journal being printed this week, and so we're reading articles from their online journal, and they're not organized in the way you typically would be hearing, so if it seems a little disorganized this week, please forgive us. So we start with restaurant trends to watch for in 2019. The average American eats out between 4 and 5 times a week, so what's trending in restaurants affects your overall lifestyle more than you might think. Here's some dining out trends to watch for in 2019. First, restaurants and retail spaces. So, retail spaces will add restaurants to improve foot traffic, Food News reported. The article noted some Capital One banks are adding cafes. Crate and Barrel is trying a restaurant model. Restoration Hardware is adding baristas and cafes to some locations, and even AT&T stores are offering food. The in-house restaurant has worked well for IKEA. Swedish meatballs, anyone? But Barnes & Noble has struggled to make it work. And another trend, new ethnic food flavors. Israeli food is poised to take off as an ethnic restaurant choice. Restaurant Business Online reported as well as food from Lebanon, Syria, Turkey, and the Balkans, sauces such as shchug, pomegranate molasses, and tahini will join ingredients like urfa and lavash in ethnic dishes. Another trend, off-premise dining. Casual dining chains will look to carry out and delivery orders to maintain market share, per Food News. Takeout and delivery accounts were up 8% of overall sales in the segment 2 years ago to 10% in 2018. Another trend, tech-enabled experiences. Almost 95% of restaurateurs think tech improves their business, and 65% of consumers will use an ordering kiosk when it's an option, business software and service provider G2 Crowd reports. Almost 3/4 of diners think technology improves their guest experience, and 61% like using handheld tablets to pay their bill. G2 Crowd predicts mobile point-of-sale systems and ordering kiosks in restaurants will increase by at least 30% in 2019. The next trend, transparency in food origins and preparation. Restaurants will increasingly share not just calorie counts, but information about the source, diet, and living conditions of ingredients they serve, and offer open concept views of the kitchen so patrons can see how their food is prepared. For example, Web Restaurant Store noted that Five Guys tells customers so they know where the potatoes used to make their French fries came from that day, and whether the food they're ordering contains ingredients like MSG, high fructose corn syrup, or gluten. And finally, functional food. Probiotics will be everywhere, including on menu notations as restaurants add the gut-enhancing ingredients to cater to diners who are trying to eat healthy, even when they're away from home. And in some financial news, the article, with $2 million in liabilities, Raleigh Independent Record Label files for bankruptcy liquidation. An 11-year-old Raleigh record label whose artists have included Blues Traveler and Lynyrd Skynyrd has filed for Chapter 7 bankruptcy protection. Hud Cole LLC, also known as Loud and Proud Records and Lipsky Music, claims to have just $7,800 worth of property. That's on top of more than $2 million in estimated liabilities listed in the filing, signed by its founder, serial music entrepreneur Tom Lipsky. Lipsky did not return a call to comment on the case, nor did his attorney, Raleigh's Gerald Juder. The company, whose gross revenue for 2017 is listed at nearly $2.3 million, is being liquidated, the petition notes. The bankruptcy petition lists a sizable inventory collection, including hundreds of CDs and posters out of bands such as Flyleaf, The String Cheese Incident, Winery Dogs, and Kix. And the list of creditors, too, is lengthy. In addition to banks and finance firms, it includes an unknown amount owed to individuals such as Jeffrey Gaccioni, the Atlanta founder of Gasworks Entertainment, Triangle entrepreneur Sean Peace, former CEO of the Royalty Exchange. It also includes unknown amounts and royalties owed involving artists it worked with, including Blues Traveler and music duo Van Zandt. It's unclear what happens to the album contracts that remain active. The bankruptcy filing claims the firm's current contracts include albums for artists such as Twisted Sister, Rick Springfield, Lynyrd Skynyrd, and the Delta Saints. Lipsky, according to Loud and Proud's Facebook profile, founded the company in 2007 on a mission to provide a true and transparent partnership between artists and their record label. Lipsky, according to the profile, had previously worked with CMC International and Sanctuary Records, delivering gold and platinum albums and DVDs for artists such as Neil Young, Widespread Panic, and the Allman Brothers. Through a joint venture with Roadrunner Records, Loud and Proud was responsible for new albums by Rush, Lenny Kravitz, Kiss, and others, according to the profile. Now, in real estate-related articles from the online articles at Triangle Business Journal, comes the article, Two Buildings at Lake Crabtree Shore Sell for $75.5 million. 9 months after entering the Triangle market with a 10-building office acquisition, Florida real estate firm Accesso Partners has made another splash in the region with a $75.5 million purchase of two office buildings on Western Parkway in Cary. Accesso Partners closed on a deal before Christmas for the Western 1 and 2 buildings located on the eastern shore of Lake Crabtree, according to county property records. The buildings total more than 290,000 square feet and were 98% leased at the time of the sale. The Western 1 building, located at 1001 Winstead Drive, was built in the 1980s and designed by Skidmore, Owings, and Merrill, according to a press release about the deal. The seller of the properties was a partnership led by Capital Associates of Raleigh. The firm bought the Western 1 property in 2006 for $41.4 million and subdivided the site, then built Western 2 at 5020 Western Parkway, which opened in 2009. Out of 15 potential buyers that toured the property, 8 made offers, Capital Associates CEO Frank Baird said in a statement. Baird's firm recently closed a deal of similar size, selling the Crescent Lakeside and Crescent Lakeside 2 buildings in South Cary for more than $68 million in October to a New York investor. Plygium Industries, a Cary-based building product manufacturer acquired by a private equity firm earlier this year, has its corporate headquarters in a portion of the Western 2 building and plans to take over the entire building in 2019. With the acquisition, Accesso Partners now owns nearly 1 million square feet of office space in the Triangle. In March, the company made its entry into the Triangle with the purchase of the 10-building Meridian Corporate Center in Durham for more than $100 million and has plans for further expansion. Raleigh-Durham-Cary is a magnet for science, technology, engineering, and professional services companies and has a highly educated workforce, many of whom graduated from the nearby research universities, who liked the quality and pace of life here and chose to stay, Accesso Managing Partner Ariel Bentata stated. HFF's Ryan Clutter, Scott Humphrey, Chris Lingerfelt, and Zach Drozda co-brokered the sale with Capital Associates. And from the technology area of Triangle Business Journal comes the article, Official, Apple is still growing in North Carolina, just not in RTP. Just because Apple rejected Triangle for its massive expansion operation doesn't mean it's not growing in the state. That's because, about 3 hours away, Apple has already committed to grow in the sleepy town of Maiden, North Carolina. Scott Miller, president of the Catawba County Economic Development Corporation, says that, according to the conversations he's had with Apple over the past year, Its interest is not waning in the data center operation it brought to the town 8 years ago. Apple recently acquired more than 230 additional acres for continuing expansions, he notes. We've sort of greased the skids in order for them to just keep rolling whenever they want, Mueller says. Obviously, we're disappointed that the project didn't go to the Triangle because it would have strengthened North Carolina even further, but I don't think it had a negative impact on us that they want Austin. Mueller says his office is in frequent touch with Apple, just as a normal part of our efforts to make sure they're here and happy and growing, but that his team was not actively involved in the state's recruitment for the Triangle Project. He continues to see Apple as a good partner for the state. They far exceeded any commitments that they ever hinted at to us, he says. We're 8 years into this relationship, and as far as I know, we haven't had any arguments whatsoever. We love them, and I think they love us. Apple began its investments in Catawba County with a single server building in 2009, a $1 billion investment. Over the years, it's more than tripled its investment in the town, including adding nearly 300 acres of solar arrays to power the facility. It's grown to half a dozen buildings, and more have been planned. The company is now the top taxpayer in Catawba County, having paid more than $6 million in county taxes last year. Last year, the firm filed plans for yet another new data center in Maiden. The $22 million, 208,000-square-foot data center will sit behind what the firm has already built in Catawba County. Altogether, Apple is expected to have invested nearly $5 billion in the county. More than 400 people, including contractors, work at the site. Apple did not respond to a request to comment for this story. Now, the following article is a result of a partnership with the Financial Times, and it's entitled Online Surge Powers U.S. Retailers' Festive Sales. A surge in online purchases helped U.S. retailers enjoy their biggest rise in festive shopping sales in 6 years, invigorating the sector at the end of a year that has seen thousands of stores close. Total U.S. retail sales, tracked by payments company MasterCard, during the crucial period between November the 1st and Christmas Eve, leapt 5.1% from a year ago to $850 billion. Online sales leapt 19.1% year-on-year, compared with 18.1% last year, and almost six times faster than sales at brick-and-mortar stores. Steve Sadove, former chief executive and chairman of Saks, who advises MasterCard, says U.S. consumer confidence had translated into holiday cheer for retail. The overall figures suggest the bright start to the holiday period reported by brands including Lululemon and Abercrombie & Fitch continued for many companies in the run-up to Christmas. Yet the scale of the shift online highlights the challenges facing stores, shopping malls, especially if consumer spending weakens in the months ahead. Separate figures from Edison Trends showed Amazon consolidating its already strong market position, with sales rising 18% in the run-up to Christmas. In contrast, department stores missed out on their festive cheer, according to MasterCard. Posting a 1.3% decline in sales over the period, their online operations fared better, with sales rising 10.2%. The data provide the latest evidence that low unemployment, rising wages, and tax cuts have kept Americans spending. Clothing sales were 7.9% higher than last year, the biggest rise since 2010, while home improvement products were up 9%. The figures come as Wall Street tries to assess whether the strong economy is masking structural problems in U.S. retail. Shares have been especially volatile this year and were among the biggest losers in the recent market-wide sell-off. Investors have looked past what had already been expected to be a strong festive period to focus on the year ahead. A recovery in the S&P's retail index has gone into reverse in recent weeks, down 17% for December. It was 0.4% lower by mid-morning on Wednesday in New York. Some of the industry's biggest names, including department store chain Sears, which filed for bankruptcy in October, have continued to falter. Bricks and mortar companies have announced more than 5,400 store closures this year, according to CoreSite Research, compared with about 3,000 openings. A surge in online purchases helped U.S. retailers enjoy their biggest rise in festive shopping sales in 6 years, invigorating the sector at the end of a year that has seen thousands of stores close. Total U.S. retail sales, tracked by payments company MasterCard during the crucial period between November 1st and Christmas Eve, leapt 5.1% from a year ago to $850 billion. Separate figures from Edison Trends showed Amazon consolidating its already strong market position, with sales rising 18% in the run-up to Christmas. The data provide the latest evidence that low unemployment, rising wages, and tax cuts have kept Americans spending. The figures come as Wall Street tries to assess whether the strong economy is masking structural problems in U.S. retail. Shares have been especially volatile this year and were among the biggest losers in the recent market-wide sell-off. Investors have looked past what already had been expected to be a strong festive period to focus on the year ahead. A recovery in the S&P's retail index has gone into reverse in recent weeks, down 17% for December. It was 0.4% lower by mid-morning on Wednesday in New York. Now, here's a second article that's a result of collaboration with the Financial Times. And the article is entitled, Tariffs Overtake Tax as Focus of Corporate America. U.S. executives and analysts are now more focused on trade war concerns than the benefits of lower corporate taxes, according to a Financial Times analyst of their public remarks since the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act became law a year ago this week. The act, which slashed headline corporate tax rates from 35% to 20% and provided incentive to repatriate cash held offshore, transformed most companies' earnings growth this year, quickly became the biggest topic of discussion between senior executives and Wall Street analysts. An analysis of transcripts of earnings calls and investor conferences published by Centio, the financial research platform, showed, however, that rising anxiety about Donald Trump's trade policy has overtaken discussion of the historic tax reform in recent months. The analysis, measuring the frequency with which various terms appear in transcripts, underscores a shift in business attitudes to two of Mr. Trump's signature economic policies, adding to questions about how lasting an impact tax reform will have on investment. Lowering corporate tax rates has helped lift sentiment across a broad range of U.S. companies, from small businesses to cash-rich multinationals, boosting capital expenditures and, to a lesser extent, hiring. Yet, measures of business optimism have already started to retreat from the highs they hit at the start of the year. The Business Roundtable said earlier this month that tariffs were acting as a headwind, countering some of the earnings-boosting benefits of the new tax regime. The Centio transcripts also show that U.S. attention to potential disruptions from Brexit has ticked up slightly in recent weeks, having previously fallen off after the initial surprise of the UK's 2016 referendum result. If you didn't have the U.S.-China relationship where it is today, I think the Brexit issue would be very much front and center in U.S. minds, Myron Brilliant, head of international affairs at the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, told the FT last week. Tom Gallagher, president of Arthur J. Gallagher's Global Property and Casualty Brokerage, told analysts earlier this month that he had no idea what would happen in March 2019 when Britain is due to leave the European Union. I don't think anybody does at this point in time. It's just confusion, he said. Marjorie Chorlins, executive director of the Chamber's U.S.-UK Business Council, said that its members were showing growing interest in the implications of Brexit for U.S. businesses. U.S. companies are factoring in the risk of no deal. There's been a lot of contingency planning, she said. Bottom line, we are looking for some certainty. We're looking for clarity and preparing for all scenarios. Most of the issues that we're dealing with today are induced by bad political choices, Fred Smith, chairman and CEO of FedEx, told analysts this week, listing U.S. tariffs and the tremendously difficult situation around Brexit among the factors slowing economies around the world. The good news is, with a change in policy, they could turn it around pretty quick too, he said. Fundamentally, we think trade will continue to grow. Now the article, e-commerce delivers warehouse gold rush. The cavernous rectangular building with views of the gantry cranes of the nearby port of Newark is not likely to win many architectural awards, but to Nick Kittredge, it's a thing of beauty. Mr. Kittredge is a senior executive at logistics real estate company Prologis. The 200,000 square foot facility in the industrial town of Elizabeth, New Jersey, is one of the latest bets on a warehouse gold rush that's being fueled by the growth of e-commerce. Rents for industrial real estate, a category that largely comprises warehouses, are rising at double-digit rates in more than a dozen U.S. markets. Vacancies are at historic lows, and new investors are piling into the sector, even as other parts of the property industry are softening. Demand for industrial in the U.S. is off the charts, said Ravathi Greenwood, head of U.S. research at Cushman & Wakefield. That market is completely on steroids. TH Real Estate, an investment manager, has estimated that total returns for warehouses will be double those of other U.S. property sectors this year. The Pension Real Estate Association is predicting they will outpace other property categories at least to the end of 2022. In some ways, the warehouse boom is the flip side of a retail property market blighted by bankruptcies and store closures as shoppers move online. Demand is so intense that in some markets, developers have taken the once unheard of step of tearing down office properties to convert them to warehouses. Eric Caldwell, Chief Operating Officer of XPO Logistics, which owns 813 warehouses, more than half outside the U.S., estimated that e-commerce now accounts for about 30% of the business. The company is opening an average of 2 new warehouse facilities each week. Consumer demand is fueling tremendous growth in retail and e-commerce, Mr. Caldwell explained. It makes for heady times for Mr. Kittredge, who runs Prologis's East Coast operations, and fellow denizens of industrial real estate, once an industrial backwater. They find themselves suddenly bathing in a limelight, typically reserved for colleagues from the more glamorous worlds of residential and commercial realty. We certainly feel that this is our time in the sun, he said. At Cushman, some of the top-ranked brokers, a matter of great prestige internally, are now industrial specialists and have even begun to feature in the company's annual presentation. All of a sudden, it's sexy to be an industrial broker, said Andrew Judd, a senior managing director, who runs a company's office in northern New Jersey, sounding as surprised as anyone. For years, that was not the case. The warehouse market was boringly stable until it was hit by the 2008 financial crisis. A strengthening economy stabilized rents after a few years. They've since taken off with the emergence of e-commerce, which is fast changing the rules of retail and logistics. Among other shifts, companies are now seeking abundant warehouse space close to their customers to manage an ever-growing volume of last-mile deliveries that must be made on ever-tighter deadlines. A retailer that used to ship goods to a store once a week now makes daily deliveries in an effort to keep pace with Amazon, the leading online retailer. Retailers must also keep a far greater supply of items in stock than they did in the bricks-and-mortar era. Several put the ratio at about 3-1. That includes extra capacity to handle the many items that online shoppers return. In 7 or 8 years, you've kind of invented a new industry, said Stan Danzig, a Cushman vice chair, who's been working in the industrial market since 1981. By way of example, Mr. Danzig pointed to New Jersey, where Amazon did not have a single warehouse as recently as 2012. Now it has 9. Wherever Amazon goes, its competitors tend to quickly follow, creating warehouse clusters. While the warehouse boom is pushing up property values across the U.S., particularly in pockets near large population centers, northern New Jersey may be its mecca. In addition to its own sizable population, it also boasts proximity to New York and the bustling port of Newark. Developers built a record 9 million square feet of new warehouse space in the state in 2017, and will surpass that with 10 million square feet this year. Rents that averaged just $5.10 per square foot in 2012 have since jumped to $8.47, according to Cushman. They appear to be accelerating, with a 17% increase in the third quarter compared with the same period a year earlier. Many of the properties are strung along the New Jersey Turnpike, where brokers refer to distinct markets by the corresponding highway exit, and rents tend to descend the further south one drives from New York. These are not the warehouses from Mr. Danzig's early days in the business. Facilities that once spanned 50,000 square feet now routinely exceed 1 million square feet. The quality of the slabs they sit atop is vital because of the accumulated pounding from so much traffic. Tenants also demand as much as 40 feet in clearance so that they can stack storage shelves high and driveways designed to accommodate the turning radius of dozens of 53-foot tractor trailers. Some of the beneficiaries include logistics specialists such as Prologis and XPO, property investors such as Bridge Development, and New York and New Jersey real estate developers, including Harts Mountain and even the Kushner family. In Edison, New Jersey, that's Exit 10, Dotcom Distribution, a company that was founded in 2000 with 150,000 square feet, now takes up half of an 851,000 square foot warehouse facility. Dotcom is a third-party logistics company, 3PL in industry parlance, that handles e-commerce operations for dozens of retailers, many in the apparel and cosmetics industry. We look at velocity. What's selling? Was how Robert Kuhn, the vice president of marketing, explained the business as a group of workers prepared for the holiday season. The facility measures 650 feet across, making workers on the far end appear like specks. Yet, Dotcom is perpetually seeking to squeeze more value from the space to try to offset rising rent and labor costs. One fix is to shift to increasingly narrow aisles, a mere 6 feet across in some places, that are traversed by wire-guided lifts that allow human pickers to scale 40-foot shelves to select merchandise for customer orders. On a recent afternoon, a picker was traversing an aisle, selecting among a wall of hundreds of trays containing men's underwear in all shapes, sizes, and styles. They belong to Underwear Expert, an online retailer that ships its customers a new pair of skivvies each month. Dotcom may not find much more space in New Jersey. Realtors say there are a few greenfield sites remaining. Many otherwise appealing plots have environmental or structural problems that may make it costly and time-consuming to develop. For Mr. Kittredge, such challenges are also a sign of his industry's transformation. For a long time, the cocktail conversation around warehouses was pretty short-lived, he recalled. But now with e-commerce, there's just a lot of excitement. Next, we find an article entitled Digital Data Gives Billboard Owners More Reason to Love a Good Traffic Jam. In fact, this story is available as a result of a content partnership with the New York Times. The increasingly lengthy commute isn't just a traffic jam, it's a captive audience for advertisers. The average one-way trip for commuters in the United States in 2017 was 26.9 minutes, according to the Census Bureau. That was up from 26.6 minutes in 2016 and added 2.5 hours to the average time commuting over the course of the year. So even in this age of Facebook, Google, Netflix, and Amazon, the companies selling seemingly old-fashioned ad space like billboards have noticed the slowing crawl. We love a good traffic jam, said John Miller, vice president of sales and sales operations for Lamar Advertising in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. We are all about eyeballs on billboards, and the increased amount of traffic is helping us. Lamar has 175,000 billboards throughout the United States, Miller said, adding that slower traffic can help the company's data collection program determine who is looking at the board and for how long. Using anonymous data from mobile devices and apps, Lamar has figured out how fast cars are passing by, how much dwell time drivers spend paying attention to billboards, what the demographics of the drivers are, and even where they live, travel, and shop. Roughly 3 years ago, Clear Channel Outdoor started its own data collection service, Radar. Using global positioning data from mobile apps that require mapping, navigation, dating, shopping, and restaurant ads, the service blends third-party demographic data with information about people passing billboards to determine not only where commuters will spend, but how. Now we're starting to understand what mobile devices we saw exposed to our billboards, and we look back in time and say, where else have we seen those devices? Said Dan Levy, Executive Vice President and Chief Marketing Officer for Clear Channel Outdoor. In the case of businesses trying to get people into Target, we say, what are the locations that are most efficient in getting people whose devices we've seen in Target? He noted that a recent analysis of fast food customers in Southern California had found a strong and perhaps counterintuitive correlation where they're going to the gym, largely because commuting whittled away time for sit-down meals and other forms of exercise. It also showed that billboards for gyms worked better when placed near a commuter's workplace than near his or her home. Miller said that data could also help digital billboards, which make up 2% of Lamar's billboard inventory, change to meet an advertiser's needs at specific times of day. That can mean a movie studio billboard's mocking traffic congestion at the height of rush hour, a Dunkin' billboard changing from coffee in the morning to sandwiches at night, or sequential billboards telling a story. Smart brands strategically choose their placements based on a deep understanding of location and audience flow, said Jeremy Mayle, Chief Executive Officer of Outfront Media. Then they match the messaging to the environment. This means creatively impactful messaging that highlights one key message, easily digestible, with a strong call to action. If advertisers can't catch commuters' eyes with billboards, they're also trying to reach them through radio. For instance, iHeartMedia, which owns Clear Channel Outdoor, has spent the last 3 years looking at listener behavior on both its radio stations and its app. Its research has produced data that iHeartMedia now sells to advertisers, along with demographic information and specific ad time. However, Robert Pittman, Chairman and Chief Executive Officer of iHeartMedia, said commuters were so bombarded with information that advertisers might get them to want a product or service in the moment, but not get them to remember once they're out of their cars. Pittman said introducing a Taco Bell breakfast menu to commuters when they're hungry, suggesting they drink Bacardi rum when they get home, or pitching a car dealership while they're stuck in their clunker put those advertisers foremost in the commuter's mind when they're most susceptible to persuasion. When 20th Century Fox was preparing to release the Queen biopic Bohemian Rhapsody this year, iHeart radio stations used peak commute times to air interviews about the rock band, Pittman said. On November the 1st, a day before the film's release, Clear Channel stations played different versions of the 6-minute title songs across all 650 iHeart radio stations and sites. The longer the commute and the more time they're in the car, the more they're looking to enjoy the experience in the car, or to make it at least more tolerable, Pittman said. We really try to make the programming that way, and we're able to bring our advertising partners into it as well. Commuters using public transportation are also a coveted audience, especially in cities like New York, where 56% of commuters used public transportation in 2017, in Boston with 35%, in San Francisco with 35%, in Washington with 33%, and Chicago with 28%. The Brooklyn advertising technology company Intersection works with transit agencies in cities like New York, Los Angeles, Chicago, San Francisco, and Philadelphia to place interactive ads, Wi-Fi hubs, and video displays in and around bus stops, train stations, and airports. Daphna Sarnoff, Intersection's chief marketing officer, said partnerships with Foursquare on navigation and with companies like ice cream maker Blue Bunny on station takeovers, like its pop-up ice cream shop in a Chicago subway station this year, had become essential to holding commuters' attention. I've seen some amazing ads on my 2 train, going back in the morning and coming back in the evening, Sarnoff said. In this market, I've seen advertisers really raise their game and people's expectations of what people are going to see when they go into the subway are high. Outfront Media is rolling out 50,000 digital video boards at subway and rail stations in New York, the Bay Area, Washington, and Boston. Brands like Casper and Seamless have become household names by sharing their brand stories with subway riders. Mail, Outfront's chief executive, said smart brands like Spotify, Street Easy, and WeWork leverage consumers' predictable travel paths, frequency, and time spent, and in-the-moment-in-time mentality to drive app usage, sales, and site visits. Now, as I mentioned, this week we're looking from the online source for our Triangle Business Journal, not a printed version. And so this article comes from the area in the Triangle Business Online called 2018 Year in Review. There were several of the 2018 Year in Review stories in last week's Triangle Business Journal. So this is a similar one of those articles. And the article is entitled, IKEA Pivots on Plans for Carry, Leaves Mall Seeking Options. IKEA's long move to Carey Town Center was supposed to inject new life into the declining mall and the town's eastern gateway. But hopes of a revival were crushed when the Swedish furniture company decided to abandon its plans in May. Carey Town manager Sean Stegall relayed the news to a town council member in an email at the time that stated, "Our worst fears have been confirmed." The store would have totaled 359,000 square feet with a price tag in the range of $70 to $80 million and resulted in empty department stores being demolished. IKEA's stated reason for leaving had nothing to do with the town. The company said it was pivoting to smaller and more urban store concepts. But that did little to limit the fallout for the mall and the town. Since May, the company that owns the shopping center, CBL & Associates Property, has struggled to come to terms with its lender, Prudential Insurance Company. A debt package secured by the mall was called in by the lender when IKEA backed out. Now, CBL is looking to sell the mall to pay off the loan, which has a balance of more than $43 million. CBL spokeswoman Stacy Keating has said the company is still considering its options, but the company's latest financial reports included a note about an anticipated sale of the mall in 2019. IKEA real estate manager Bob Grimsley says the furniture company would still like to open a store in the area, but IKEA has not announced a timeline or a specific location in the Triangle. And along with the previous article, here's another one of the 2018 Year in Review articles, entitled, Despite Some Closures, Triangle Brewers Expect Growth Ahead. The Triangle has seen a number of local breweries close in the past 3 years, including White Rabbit, Triangle Brewing Company, G2B Restaurant and Brewery, Blackjack, and Mystery Brewing Company. But despite the losses, many in the industry believe there will be more openings than closing in 2019. Folks get so passionate about beer to the point of opening up their own brewery, says Adam Eckhart, co-founder of Crank Arm Brewing. The Raleigh Brewery is in its 5th year and in the middle of an expansion that will see its distribution of 1,850 barrels in 2017 at least triple. But passion alone won't keep a brewery open. A multitude of things can go wrong, as in any business, and if things go wrong at once, you'll have to close your doors, Eckhart said. The days of being local and getting a pass have ended because the market has matured, and many beer drinkers are more sophisticated than 3 years ago. While there is still a call for some of the more basic styles of beers, the current beer connoisseur is now more apt to pick up a New England IPA, pastry stout, barrel-aged beer, or an occasional sour with a brewery's local strain of Brettanomyces. Like wine drinkers, most craft beer drinkers enjoy a variety, and while some have their go-to labels, decisions can be based on weather, time of day, mood, and food, says Ryan Kolarov, co-owner of Raleigh's Neuse River Brewing. Les Stewart of Trophy Brewing in Raleigh believes that, just like any other local businesses, it comes down to the business model. Bad luck, stability of the investment pool, all these things contribute, he says. But Stewart adds, I'll worry about it when the failure rate of independent breweries starts to approach the failure rates of independent restaurants. Quality is essential, brewers say. It's more important than ever to maintain a unique brand identity and quality on the market, says Eric Knight, the hoopla czar at Carbro's Silver String Brewery. He says there are no excuses for mediocre beer at this point. I would expect a few more closings in the Triangle in the coming year, but the openings will still outpace the closings, Knight predicts. Many U.S. breweries sprout from home brewers fed up with their jobs. But brewery isn't an instant cash cow. A major reason I've seen closures is high, self-paid salaries without the work to match, Kolarov says. If I pay myself $60,000 as a president and don't add $60,000 worth of value, I'm potentially taking away two $30,000 salaries from seller positions or expansion opportunities such as a cooperage or a canning line. Many brewers say the local shops will continue to innovate and thrive. For example, Kolarov says Neuse River Brewing will continue to make changes in its ever-evolving beer-making program. Eckhart adds, local beer drinkers are super savvy, which is great. They demand a greater variety of high-quality beer, which pushes brewers to vary their styles and improve their beers. This next article is, once again, a result of a content partnership with the New York Times, like at least one other article in today's program, and I think qualifies probably for the cover story. And it's entitled, How For-Profit Cosmetology Schools Entangle Students in Debt. When she was in cosmetology school, Tracy Lozano had a love-hate relationship with weekday mornings. Those pre-dawn moments were the only time she saw her infant daughter awake, and she savored them. When the time came to hand the baby to her mother, she said recently she would stifle her tears, letting them roll only when she had closed the door behind her. She'd put on a game face when she pulled into the parking lot of the Iowa School of Beauty, just outside Des Moines. From what Lozano could tell, a cosmetology license was a realistic way to ensure a better life, and she was willing to make sacrifices. While also working nights at a Pizza Hut, she borrowed $21,000 to cover tuition and salon supplies and put in eight-hour days at the school for the better part of a year. The amount of time Lozano spent learning to give haircuts, manicures, and facials was enormous, but the requirement was set by the state, and she didn't much question it. She was determined to earn enough money to move out of her mother's house. Only a few weeks after getting her cosmetology license in 2005, she was hired at a local Great Clips. The job, though, paid just $9 an hour, which meant that her days double-shifting at Pizza Hut weren't over. Even with tips, Lozano didn't earn more than $25,000 in any of her first few years as a cosmetologist. For years, she relied on food stamps and health insurance from the state. She couldn't cover living expenses and keep chipping away at her loan payments. 13 years after graduating, she still owes more than $8,000. What Lozano didn't know was the state-regulated school system she'd put her faith in relies on a business model in which the drive for revenue often trumps students' educational needs. For-profit schools dominate the cosmetology training world and reap money from taxpayers, students, and salon customers. They've beaten back attempts to create cheaper alternatives, even while miring their students in debt. In Iowa in particular, the companies charge steep prices, nearly $20,000 on average for a cosmetology certificate, equivalent to the cost of a two-year community college degree twice over. And they fought to keep the required number of school hours higher than anywhere else in the country. Each state sets its own standards. Most require 1,500 hours, and some, like New York and Massachusetts, require only 1,000. Iowa requires 2,100. That's a full year's worth of 40-hour work weeks, plus an extra 20. By comparison, you can become an emergency medical technician in the state after 132 hours at a community college. Put another way, an Iowa cosmetologist who has a heart attack can have her life saved by a medic with 1/16 her training. There's little evidence that spending more hours in school leads to higher wages, nor is there proof that extra hours result in improved public safety. But one relationship is clear. The more hours that students are forced to be in school, the more debt they accrue. Among cosmetology programs across the nation, Iowa's had the fourth highest median student debt in 2014, according to federal data. Walk into any hair salon in Iowa, and you're likely to find a stylist making $10 an hour who loves her job, but is struggling to pay off her student loans. Over 10 months in visits to a dozen salons and in conversations with 37 former Iowa cosmetology students and an additional 25 in other states, we heard a variety of opinions about how much training the profession requires and the financial returns it offers. And we heard again and again how the dream of becoming a professional hairstylist or someday owning a salon can be stymied by debt. The issue is national. More than 177,000 people enroll in for-profit beauty schools across the United States each year, which on average charge more than $17,000 for tuition, fees, and supplies to earn a cosmetology certificate. Across the Iowa border in Fremont, Nebraska, Ashley Sandoval makes $10.50 an hour at another Great Clips location. In the 5 years since she graduated from cosmetology school, she said interest has ballooned her debt from $22,000 to $29,000. "I'll be paying it off for the rest of my life," Sandoval said. The Iowa Cosmetology School Association, which acts on behalf of several of the 13 companies that own schools in the state, would not make a representative available for an interview. But the association did provide written responses to questions through its lobbyist, Therese A. Harms. The group said that its primary concern was successfully preparing students, not making money, and that differences in state regulations made comparing hours difficult. The association also doesn't see the crippling student debt as the school's fault, citing the fact that students are allowed to take out more in loans than is necessary to cover educational expenses. "We have students graduating with minimal debt because they made wise choices," the association said. Cosmetology schools have a unique business model in the for-profit school world. They have two main streams of revenue. The first comes from students, often in the form of taxpayer-funded grants and loans to pay for the tuition. Cosmetology schools took in nearly $1.2 billion in federal grants and loans during the 2015-16 school year. The second stream is the salon work the students do while in school. They spend some time in classrooms learning about, for example, chemicals and how to sanitize the workspace. But once they've hit a certain number of hours, they start working on real clients in salons run by the schools. In full-time programs, going to school becomes a full-time job, where students clock in and out for 7 or 8 hour shifts. The total number of required hours varies, but all states require some amount of practice with paying customers. In Iowa, students spend 715 hours in the classroom and 1,385 hours on the floor. Prices for these salon services, which include haircuts, manicures, facials, and at some schools, massages, are typically set below market rates to attract customers. These salons also sell shampoo, conditioner, and other beauty products. One Iowa student said he and others had gotten perks if they sold enough products. Another student who sued a school in Pennsylvania reported that her grades were partly based on whether she offered salon products to clients. The schools don't have to pay students for the services they provide. In fact, the students pay tuition for the hours they work in the salons. All told, for-profit cosmetology schools nationwide brought in more than $200 million in revenue for their salons in the 2015-16 school year, according to federal statistics. Most schools are small, privately owned entities that do not have to disclose their profits. Without the revenue coming from those salons, most of these schools wouldn't be profitable, or it would be marginal, said Leon Greenberg, a lawyer in Las Vegas who has examined the financial documents of several schools he unsuccessfully sued under the Fair Labor Standards Act. It's pretty much ingrained in their business model. Some schools have pushed their business models to the legal limit and beyond, according to government regulators. LaJames International College owns 6 of the 27 cosmetology schools in Iowa, plus one in Nebraska and another in Illinois. Iowa's Attorney General sued the school in 2014, accusing it of defrauding students through deceptive marketing and enrollment practices. Under a settlement, the school admitted no wrongdoing, but agreed to forgive almost $2.2 million in student debt. It had to pay a $500,000 fine, and the owners, Cynthia Betcher and her son Travis Betcher, had to personally pay fines of $25,000 each. The federal government also placed LaJames under restrictive monitoring for alleged mishandling of students' financial aid. The Betchers declined to comment on the suit. Lisa Shaw, a former LaJames massage instructor, said Cynthia Betcher had met with staff members regularly and often told them, "This is a business first and a school second." Shaw and Bez Lancio McMullen, a former LaJames cosmetology instructor at the campus in Davenport, Iowa, recalled attending meetings in which company officials spoke of the need to maintain sizable profits. Students were regularly pulled out of Lancio McMullen's classes to work in the salon, she said. Other complaints submitted to the Attorney General's office about the school describe similar practices, although the Betchers have consistently denied their claims. Both women eventually resigned because they objected to the way students were being treated. Shaw left in 2014, saying the customer's owners looked at students as dollar signs. "I feel like the school is predatory," Shaw said. "I could no longer be a part of taking people's money and then treating them like that." Stephanie Wood Betcher, who is the school's director of marketing, denied that Cynthia Betcher would ever tell employees to put the school's business needs first. Education and betterment of the student is always and has always been the number one priority for her and LJIC, Wood Betcher wrote in an email. LaJames had to open his books during the Attorney General's lawsuit, revealing annual profits that range from $1.2 million to $3.4 million from 2009 through 2012. In Iowa, tuition fees and supplies for its cosmetology program come to $21,500 per student. "Compared with other institutions, I think we're cheap," Travis Betcher said, noting that the cost includes books and supply kits. "We're private. We're not public. We don't get tax breaks." The Betcher family also owns more than a dozen limited liability companies, which include a distribution center for salon products. In 2017, the U.S. Department of Education reprimanded LaJames for failing to publicly disclose a rape in a dorm in Nebraska. Federal law requires colleges to publish annual security reports and logs about crimes on campus, which LaJames failed to do, exposing students and staff to potential harm, according to government reviewers. Joni Beresh, the school's compliance officer, said in an email that the security reports were available to students and that she believed that the law requiring crime logs did not apply to campuses like the one in Nebraska. She acknowledged that a rape had been reported to police, but said that school officials, honestly, are not confident that this rape incident ever occurred. Beresh said they had now filed the paperwork requested by the federal reviewers. In the past 5 years, legislators in at least 11 states have introduced bills to lower the number of hours required for a cosmetology certificate. These efforts are driven by a mix of anti-regulatory libertarians, national salon chains that are having trouble hiring enough qualified stylists, and the National Association for Cosmetologists, which wants its members to be able to carry their licenses across state lines. While aggressive lobbying by schools has managed to stall or defeat legislation in several states, at least 8 have reduced the number of hours in their regulations. In recent years, required hours were lowered to 1,500 in South Dakota and Montana. And Nebraska legislators, after a long battle with the schools, trimmed their mandate to 1,800. Administrators from schools in those states disagreed with reductions, but said they were still able to cover the same material as before. Iowa, with its 2,100-hour standard, remains an embarrassment, said Don Pettengill, a Republican state representative who will retire next month. Hoping to lower the profession's barrier to 2018, Pettengill this year introduced legislation that would drop the hours to 1,500. Republicans in the Senate proposed a similar bill. Schools and their lobbyists mounted a fierce pushback. The schools were livid, said State Senator Jason Schultz, a Republican subcommittee chairman. "I didn't expect the amount of opposition." The school association's political action committee had given more than $20,000 to Iowa candidates since 2014. It also had 3 lobbyists registered with the state for the last session. The The organization paid the lobbyist company $12,500. While the dollar amounts weren't huge, a little goes a long way in Des Moines. Hearings weren't publicized or even required, giving an advantage to the well-organized group. The schools argued that maintaining 2,100 hours was crucial to ensuring that students were able to learn everything needed to run salons in rural parts of the state, including nails, aesthetics, business, and state law, not just hairstyling. Their courses, they said, provide more depth than those in other states. A review of cosmetology curriculums nationally, however, shows that most states teach subjects beyond hairstyling. More than half explicitly mandate instruction in law or business topics. The Iowa School Association also maintained that important differences in regulations complicated comparisons of schools across state lines. In Massachusetts, for example, a recent graduate must work under supervision for 2 years. We do not feel it's necessary to lower the standards of Iowa's education just because other states have done so, the association said. It doesn't make sense to us to produce graduates that come out of our programs with less skill, less confidence, and who are less likely to succeed. At a subcommittee hearing on the Senate bill, only one person testified in favor of fewer hours. Schultz said that he had wanted the bill to move forward, but since only one child showed up, he couldn't justify it. Both bills died in committee. It's not clear how much money the schools would lose if they no longer had students working on salon floors for so many hours. In Nebraska, schools argued at hearings that they would have to raise their tuition to make up for lost revenue if the state reduced the hours. LaJames supported but did not testify in favor of Iowa's legislation, and the Empire Education Group, which owns the nation's largest chain of cosmetology schools, has backed legislation in Ohio to drop the hour requirement to 1,000. The increased scrutiny on cosmetology regulations at the state level follows a federal Department of Education effort starting in 2009 to crack down on for-profit schools that charge high tuitions for credentials that do not yield to well-paying jobs. The figure for all cosmetology programs nationally was 24%. Well, that music means we've run out of time for today's episode of Triangle Business Journal. We hope you've enjoyed it. Be certain to listen next time. I'm Alton Banks, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, triangleReadingService.org. So long till next time. If you have comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. 919-832-5138. And Happy New Year.